Then the last presentation for today is Central City Concerns Recuperative Care Program, Transforming the Hospital Discharge for Patients Facing Homelessness. And our presenter is Nick Granum. Nick is a program manager with Central City Concern in Portland, Oregon, providing housing for medically vulnerable adults facing homelessness at discharge from a hospital. He sits on the Respite Care Providers Network Steering Committee with the National Healthcare for the Homeless Council and is a program participant in the IHI Triple Aim Initiative. Nick is also a volunteer firefighter in the Portland area. Thanks, Nick.
That's my disclosure, right?
So I couldn't think of a disclosure, so I am full-time employed with Central City Concerns. So it's my job to do this stuff. So the Recuperative Care Program is part of a larger nonprofit, Central City Concern. So we're a small part of a big comprehensive approach to ending homelessness in Portland. Central City Concern is also one small part of what Portland in general as a community is doing. So just that's an important caveat that this isn't everything that's happening in Portland. We're just a small part of the picture. But the Recuperative Care Program, I kind of build it as a housing primary care team. So it's housing first. So that's an important part of it. It's primary care, getting people directly into primary care, and then it's a team, and I'll talk more about how this works. So if you've been to the hospital, you may have had a conversation similar to this, at least the first part. So the hospital provider, sometimes a social worker, sometimes a hospitalist, sometimes a discharge planner, nurse, care manager, somebody says, go home, take care of yourself, get lots of sleep, take your medications, make sure to stay dry, go see your doctor, and then come back and see me in a couple weeks, right? Do some follow-up. That's a common conversation when people are leaving the hospital across the country. However, the patient says, that sounds great. I don't have a home. I'd love to take care of myself, but I can't sleep all night where I camp. My medications were just stolen. My sleeping bag is soaked and lost. I don't have a doctor, which is huge. And I don't have a phone or a way to get back to the hospital. So thank you for all that wonderful advice and discharge planning. But I can't do any of those things. And so so essentially, in Portland, the hospital provider said, okay, we can't handle this anymore. We're not going to do this. And they said, this is what we need. They said, so we have an interesting hospital system in Portland. Unique from, other cities have similar systems to this, but the unique thing about Portland's hospital system is they compete on charity care and that sort of thing. It's not, in some cities there's one large hospital that provides a lot of care to people without insurance, but in Portland everybody sees all the patients essentially. So that's a good thing that's a good thing for a program like us that everyone kind of says, okay, we've got to work together. So as the program has grown, the entire hospital system participates, which is great. So my hypothesis is, the premise of the program is that timing matters. As a clinical intervention, just-in-time housing can be critical for long-term success while providing cost savings and improved health. So really, it's today that it matters. It's not 2 months from now when you're eligible or last year when you were eligible, now you're not anymore. Especially for the hospital system in Portland, it's right now that they need it, and so they built this program to address it right when they need it and right when the patient needs it and not when the system is ready for them. So this is a picture of our team from a couple years ago. I like to show that because it looks like we're from NYPD Blue or something, but the idea is that it takes a team of folks to help people transition out of the hospital. And one person can't do this alone, for sure. It's a team effort. This is five or six of us, you know, out of 650 employees at Central City Concern. So it's just coming in the door. And what this team does, the pathway, so the conversation happens between the hospital provider and the patient. And one of these members of the team goes to the hospital and says, all right, hey, we're from Central City Concern. What can we do? It looks like you're in the hospital. They called us. Do you want to come to this program? What do you think? And people say, yeah, that's awesome. Or some people are like, nah, it's not for me right now. I actually have a better place that I don't want to go. But most people, they've seen us, and then we go pick them up from the hospital. and then there's not the discharge to the streets or discharge to someplace. Go find this place on the brochure. And that's what the hospitals wanted. They wanted somebody to come get them out of the hospital. So so to give you an idea of kind of the primary diagnosis for why people come into the recuperative care program, a lot of abscesses, infections, fractures, respiratory disorders, a lot of trauma. So these acute hospitalizations are what get people into the program. And this is just the primary diagnosis. A lot of folks have secondary diagnosis. Things like homelessness are very underdiagnosed. I mean, they're kind of assumed, and then they're never written in the chart, unfortunately. But obviously, we know these cause problems. And it can go in the coding, so it just isn't usually the first one. But a lot of infections. If people are leaving the hospital with an infection and don't have a place to go, they're going to come right back. So it's immediate supportive housing. We're part of a larger system. We have 25 units at this building, which is since we're being recorded. It's low barrier housing, meaning that people can come right in. You don't have to be eligible based on homelessness. You don't have to be eligible based on being drug and alcohol free. It's immediate housing for essentially suicidal ideation, homicidal ideation, or rule outs. So people that would need to be in a psych unit can't come. But if you're stable on your medications and compelling for the hospital system, then and facing homelessness at discharge, you're able to come to this program. So it's a never a dull moment. But we have 25 beds in this building, 25 rooms, and we have about 1,600 as an agency. So this is just a pathway into housing. And then people leaving the program, about 18% over the life of the program have gone back to the streets after about a month of average stay in the program. But most people get into something else, something stable besides what they were doing before. The permanent housing is about 23% because that's difficult based on as Catherine talked about, that the supply and demand don't always meet up. But a lot getting into transitional housing, at least something. People connecting with family and friends, moving back into places that they didn't have access to before because they couldn't sit down and take a moment to breathe. And then other can include things like going back to the hospital and jail, prison, et cetera. So since 2005, we've had about 900, almost 1,000 referrals. That accounts for 835 unique patients. So I like to add this up that it's about 85 years of housing that was funded explicitly by the hospital system in Portland. That just by itself, I like to say, because the hospital system is not designed to end homelessness, and they say that a lot. It's important to acknowledge, but also they, through this initiative with just-in-time work, they really are making a difference in Portland. So the third piece of it is established primary care. We're part of a federally qualified healthcare for the homeless site. It's a community health center called the Old Town Clinic. And being part of it means we're actually part of it. Patients that come into the program get an appointment with advanced access right away. They're established. We do the paperwork sometimes in the car on the way from the hospital, so they're in the door. They don't have to have an appointment to do the paperwork and then get in. It's just right in the door to primary care. And we've even had patients who the hospital hospitals are so compelled to send them to us just to get them into primary care because they need follow-up in the community. So that's an important piece of what we do is getting people into primary care. And then that means that 2 years from now when they have another recurrence of something, if they get an infection again, they can go to see their doctor instead of waiting until they get hospitalized. So just to give you an idea of an individual patient that was pretty compelling, this patient prior to RCP had about $85,000 in charges in the hospital system. This is a patient that was fully insured. So one of our HMO partners, Care Oregon, has they see all of their all the costs for patients. So $85,000 in cost, and that changed to $935 in costs afterwards. That means they were paying. I think they bought a wheelchair. They had to go to the doctor a couple times. You know, that sort of thing costs money afterwards. But and then it costs money to get into RCP. So they're kind of a big difference in costs. Also, other things like durable medical equipment cost more after coming into the system. Coming to the clinic cost more. Mental health services cost more. But they didn't have as much ambulance costs. And so before RCP, things cost a lot, but they weren't paying much for primary care. After RCP, other things didn't cost as much, but primary care costs went up. So it's important to acknowledge that costs can go up when people are hooked into the system, but it's the right cost, I think. That's the argument, at least. So this is where a huge caveat to this data is that, to these data are that local costs and what each hospital pays are different. And so you can kind of insert your own costs, talk to your hospital about what costs they have, and they can kind of insert it in there. They probably won't tell you how much it costs for a patient to be in the hospital. But so the first estimate is, on average, we could say that patients who are facing homelessness at discharge from the hospital leave 5 days later if they don't have a place to go. So they stay in the hospital for 5 extra days. That's kind of a low ball, actually. Patients sometimes spend 10, 15 extra days. Someone with a centrally inserted, peripherally inserted catheter, a PICC line, can sometimes stay 4 to 6 weeks longer in the hospital, which is a long time, and that costs a little bit of money for somebody to be in the hospital when they could be somewhere else. So if you say that's $250 a day, which you may know, sometimes that's a little bit more than that per day in the hospital. But say it's $250 a day. For these 989 patients, that's about $1.23 million in savings. So that's less than the amount that they paid for this program, though. So you're like, wait a minute, okay, so what are some other cost savings? And these are just in reduced bed days. Also, there's the opportunity cost. Not all admissions are bad, right? Admissions are necessary for a hospital to stay open. If they don't have patients, then they close. So the cost of having somebody in a bed that doesn't have another admission coming into that bed is a huge opportunity cost. So if somebody's unnecessarily in the hospital, as you may know, they're losing revenue. So if you average about $5,500 per admission over these same patients, so the 5 days reduces one opportunity for an admission, that's about $5.5 million in savings. And this is just the bed days difference. So a lot of the just-in-time, not accounting for the readmission rates and improved health and all the costs of the rest of the system. So so as I said, again, we're part of a comprehensive solutions to ending homelessness and achieving self-sufficiency. That's our mission statement at Central City Concern. It's a large agency doing a lot of things. Has several different programs. Housing is the box within which we do the work. So that's essentially you can't end homelessness without ending homelessness, as people say. So you gotta have people have to have a place to live if they're not gonna be homeless, which makes a lot of sense. So, and then helping people be successful once they get there makes a huge difference. So with that, I think I'm going to leave up my last slide and time for questions, because that's why you're all here. So I'll sit down and sit.
Thank you to all the presenters and participants. I think we have about 11 minutes, so whenever a question is asked, if the person responding can repeat it into the microphone so it can be recorded. Any questions?
I'm from Boston. Thank you all. It was really great. One of the things I want to ask is, So the stabilization, stabilization component, once they're out of the hospital, or are you doing other things to help keep them housed other than just the health care, which is huge, but education, career, things like that as well? I didn't quite get into that, but I'm just wondering. Okay. And then a tag on to that, to your program, it sounded a little bit like a step down. What's the length of stay in your program?
Sure. Everybody got the question. How do you stabilize?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, because it's recording. Right.
What's your
Well, we have a 92% housing retention rate at Pathways to Housing Philadelphia.
Greater than a year.
Yes, but
so
John.
Yeah.
No, we're monitoring.
Okay, yeah.
But because we have a multidisciplinary assertive community treatment team, there's intensive supports in terms of education and community integration. And the stabilization, we always say, like, housing first, what next? You've got your whole life ahead of you then. So the process is really, really meeting people where they are for the first, you know, it could be for the first week or the first year. But after that, moving people beyond Pathways to Housing and, you know, their own goals has been huge and the most rewarding part of the process. We're 3 years into it, so that's as much as we know.
So the question for Boston was, see if I can get this right, what was the length of stay? I mean, what happens once people get in and where do they go? Is that kind of the idea? Yeah. So in the program explicitly, this program is about 30 days on average. That's what the hospitals pay for. But that's an average. People stay in the program sometimes longer, 2 or 3 months, depending on their acute condition, essentially, that brought them to that program. The patient who is demonstrated up here actually moved into the same building. So patients that are especially complex and unable to go other places will just kind of hold them. So it depends on the patient is a good answer. So patients that need the intervention in an ongoing way. And not everyone takes the same trajectory through the program. So some patients are recuperating, and we've had patients who are established with hospice and move into nursing facilities afterwards. So it's kind of designed as a chance for stabilization, but it doesn't mean everybody follows the same path.
Just as far as hospital to home, they have an intensive care manager for the program, and then once they're linked with the community programs, there's also a care manager there. And I know they have some involvement in assisting with outside areas. I just don't know the specifics of it, but I know from a particular patient that I know they were helping her with job. With her job. But, yeah. For their chronic public and outreach program, there is nothing along those lines at this point.
I'm from Florida, and we have a situation locally without ever spending time only here. The bottom line is we have an odd sort of reversal that we have sort of a dedicated stream of funding for healthcare for low income. And but what we don't have really a concerted effort on the homeless people and bringing all the pieces together. And I'm just curious as to, and unfortunately I was a few minutes late at the beginning at an earlier meeting, and so my question becomes, if a community like ours is trying to get them all together, what are your thoughts on how do you do that to bring them to the table and move forward?
Great. So the question is about if a community has one or another aspect of the ending homelessness panoply of services available. So maybe they have healthcare services available but not housing. How do you bring everybody together to line up everything? So,
yep.
In a difficult political climate, right? So, so I'm good at. So a couple different things. Through the 100,000 Homes campaign, there's lots of resources on the website, but I wouldn't want you to end there. We are working with communities across the country. There's a dedicated team of staff. We're working with communities across the country to do exactly what you're talking about, to try to figure out how to pull together a local team who cross the different silos of sectors to make sure that everybody's working together to end homelessness in the community. Because someone experiencing homelessness doesn't just need the home, or isn't just, as Ryan was saying, someone who drinks alcohol a lot. But the folks experiencing the homelessness are, like any of us, have needs all over the map, right? So we're working on helping communities to build teams that reflect all of those human needs, not just the housing or the health, but the whole thing. Specifically, there's where we have a Eastern U.S. field organizer who I can connect you with. I'm happy to talk with you about that afterwards, and she's been in Florida a couple times a month for the last year or so, I would say, and she's working with communities all around Florida. The brunt of homelessness, 70% of homelessness across the U.S. is located in Florida, Texas, and California, so those three states were doing lots of heavy work. So I'm happy to connect you up, but there's specific, we have tools to help communities think through who they ought to bring into that local team. We have tools to help communities figure out all the different avenues to housing placement, all the different ways that you do have access to housing, even if at first glance it looks like you don't. And there's monthly calls that we share interesting innovations with people around the country. Ryan's actually going to be speaking on our call this Wednesday. I invite you to that and to the other calls monthly as well. And we're really happy to offer the TA directly to you. So I'm not sure if there's a particular question you'd like us to help you think through. Or
I guess what I'm not hearing here is the housing piece. I think it's mostly to you. Because it's about housing. Innovation is here, but housing and immediate access to housing. Mm-hmm. And how do we actually push for that in a country that accepts places like Connecticut and say, we are absolutely solving homelessness. We put $150 million into this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the question is, why isn't scattered site at the center of the efforts of ending homelessness? And I think the 100,000 Homes campaign that I was discussing a little earlier, the entire aim of the campaign is to end chronic homelessness within 3 years, and the definition of ending it is by connecting people into permanent housing. So it definitely is, it is the point of the campaign, and the driving force of the campaign is helping people who are living currently, you know, in all different places not meant for human habitation, to help them get back into their own home that they can call their own and have a specific lease for and all of that. The reason that we have, I'm not sure, part of the question might be about the model that I share that has a few different aspects to it, but what we figured out through years of doing this work, when we were part of a New York-based organization called Common Ground, was that identifying housing resources ended up being one aspect of a wider spectrum of work that we had to get done if we were going to help people to maintain that housing and if we were going to, basically, if we're going to end homelessness. So the Common Ground, which the campaign grew out of, is a provider of permanent supportive housing and developed a particular kind of street outreach that uses that survey I mentioned before. What we realized about 10 years into the 20-year history was that building permanent supportive housing, like what you're discussing in Connecticut, wasn't on its own ending homelessness, because we were finding that the people we were welcoming into housing were not the ones who were most in need of permanent supportive housing. So that's when we built the outreach tool to make sure we were targeting the housing to people who were most in need of that housing and least likely to get into housing without aggressive support to help them get into the housing. So the model hinges on offering permanent supportive housing and helping people get into that housing. But the housing alone, you're right, building a bunch of housing doesn't on its own end homelessness. That there's a whole lot of work that goes around making sure we identify people who are most likely to die with continued homelessness, work with them to build trust and help them to come back inside, and then provide services to make sure that the transition from living outside, the average that we're seeing across the country is that people have been living outside for over 4 years. When you look at the 43% of people who are vulnerable, that average is almost 6 years. So if you've been outside for almost 6 years and now you're living in your own place and there's walls around you, it can be kind of weird, right? So the services are there to help to make sure that transition works out really smoothly. So that ending the homelessness has to involve what we found, all of those different elements. And our colleague from Florida, I think, is pointing that out also, right? Like if you have one aspect of it, but you don't have the whole local team to try to sort this out, it's going to be hard to push the ball further. So that's why we're focusing on the whole spectrum. But I appreciate the concern that the urgency is really making sure we end homelessness by hooking people up with housing. Right? Like that's what's going to end it. Go ahead, Brent.
We started setting up focus groups to ask about people's interests, and I think that's something where we had a partnership with another agency, and I think that is something we are definitely working on. Once it was expressed that there was an interest for that group of consumers that we had.
And changing our own policies around use of cigarettes.
Yes.
Which is huge.
Thank you for everyone. We need to get out of here.